Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. If you're listening to this, and it's July 11th, 2010, you're live with us, coming to you from North Carolina tonight. It's been wonderful being off for a couple of weeks, a well-deserved traipse around the country. Last week was the eSETI conference in Trout Lake, Washington. Sold-out event, folks. Sold-out event. Could not get another soul in that meeting hall. And we were not let down. Again, the skies were full of activity. The solar wind today is a very low 267.7 kilometers per second, and the proton count is around 3.7, actually pretty aggressive. Sunspot 1087 has been erupting for 3 days now with C-class flares, but facing away from Earth. Tomorrow, it will face Earth. When the flares occur, it will take about 73 hours for the particles to reach our atmosphere. The magnetosphere will direct most of the particles away from Earth, but the cosmic rays will be significant, forming high-altitude clouds. Satellite transmissions, including the aging GPS network, may be affected. Remember, the upgrading of the GPS network of satellites is about 2 years behind schedule, contract problems. And so you might have problems with your mapping system. You might have problems with your cell phone. If you still are using pagers, you may have problems with that as well. So if you have a business that operates off of the Internet and you rely on electronic data interchange, also known as EDI, you better back up. You better back it up, because this is going to be a geomagnetic storm like we have not seen in about 6 years. It looks like solar cycle 24 is beginning to wake up. There were only 17 earthquakes over 3.0 on the Richter scale, only 2 over 5 on the Earth. None were over 6, although Southern California was shaken up a couple of days ago with one just over 5. All seems to be quiet on planet Earth. We'll see what happens when the geomagnetic storm of the sun reaches the Earth. Speaking of Earth, our first hour tonight, what we want to do is talk about Earth changes, Earth conditions, some of which are man-made and some of which are natural. Volume 4 of The Arc of Millions of Years. Yes, I know we said we were only going to do 3 volumes, but so many things that we talked about in the first 1,500 pages of the book have come true. Things that we predicted in The Arc of Millions of Years have come to pass, which means that the theories that we purported in those volumes were accurate, because if they were not accurate, these things would not be coming to pass. And we're not talking about esoteric things. We're talking about earthquakes, storms, patterns, gravitational changes, and those kinds of things, as well as very strange weather patterns and things that we are discovering in our own sun, are going to be included in Volume 4. It's important because it'll make a good historical record, and it will also empower those who are just now getting to the point where they're reading this genre, as well as those who have been reading it a long time and been reading a lot of inaccurate inflated and exaggerated garbage. Once you're empowered with accurate truth and lined history, that is to say, history that's aligned with those scientific predictions, then you can be empowered to make a change in your life. And if you make a change in your life, you'll make a change in those lives around you. And before you know it, the planet will be heading in a different direction, which many say might not be a bad thing about now. Don't forget, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. I add stuff pretty much every day. Okay, not every day, but sometimes multiple times in a single day. As we approach the announcement of the Inner Earth Expedition, the launch of the nation's first affordable electric vehicles, and other great stuff, so follow me on Twitter by searching for Brooks Agnew, and you can always go to xsquaredradio.com, and the Twitter record is right there, so you can just jump on and please retweet as often as possible. Some of the things that we say need to get out there in a big way. Some of the great people that we met at eSETI this last week, oh my goodness, I was so excited to meet William Henry again and to see his latest research. He is an Egyptian mythologist that of unprecedented accomplishment. If you ever get a chance to see his presentation, I highly recommend it. We also met Shelley Yates. Those of you not familiar with that name, Fire the Grid. Does that ring a bell? It's happening again. Fire the Grid 2. 11-11-11 at 11-11. Very auspicious numerology. But Shelley Yates is a very energetic speaker who can go on extemporaneously about her experience and what she has brought back from her near-death experience, or should I say her death experience. Really enlightening eSETI conference. There is rumor of a fall event. That would be history-making, my friends, if you get a chance to keep up with that here on BBS Radio Network. By the way, we are a proud member of the BBS Radio Network now, closing out our fifth year with BBS. Happy to grow with them and happy to be part of, notably, the most listened to internet radio network in the world, bar none. So we'll take a quick 40-second prep, and then we'll get into the news, and we'll see where this takes us tonight. Open lines all night. I know I haven't been here for 2 weeks. A lot of you have pent-up questions and things, experiences that you want to share on the air. So you can reach us at 415-762-1161, 415-762-1161. If you can get to a cell phone tower on planet or off planet, you can reach us right here at X Squared Radio. Be right back. 40 seconds. Don't go away. Veritas means truth in Latin. Mel Fabregas is the host of Veritas. I had the distinct pleasure of meeting with him and a degreed geologist working on his graduate studies, Ben. We put together a very aggressive film documentary, sort of a interview while we were at eSETI. It was late one night, about midnight, and this whole BP oil spill is such a twisted, amazing chain of events. We've discussed it a couple times on this program, but as we bring the experts together, as we look at the news, as we look at the activities of various leaders in that industry, we can see some strange goings on. And thank goodness that there are people like Mel out there who are very passionate about this, very passionate about earth conditions and about our responsibility with the ecology of the earth. And ad hoc, literally ad hoc, in the middle of the night, he shows up, camera in hand, and the fanciest digital recorder I've ever seen. And we put together a one-hour interview. That interview is on the Veritas website. If you would like to go to it, we will have a link to it in tonight's episode in the archive of X Squared Radio. It's important that you listen to this, not so much because the news is going to change in the next week or two, but because this lays down the history of what might be one of the most exposed movements of money and power that did not involve war in human history. And the BP oil spill is about to take a twist, it seems. While the reporters have been banned under threat of federal Class B felony charges and a $40,000 fine from approaching cleanup workers, there have been reports of tar and oil deposits being dumped in landfills. That's right, cleaned up off the beaches where the tourists might be, loaded into trucks, shoveled into trucks, not hazmat barrels, not sequestered away to be recycled somehow at a later date. Far from it. Dumped right in the landfills. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever worked in the oil industry. I have worked in the oil industry, and I can tell you it's a mess. It is a mess when you're drilling. It's a mess when you're pumping. It's a mess when you're transporting. Anytime you ever go to the oil fields, anywhere in Kentucky, Tennessee, Texas, Georgia, California, the first thing you notice when you top the hill is the smell. Well, you don't have to go to the oil fields now to smell that smell. All you have to do is go to the beach. All you have to do is sail the inner waterways in Louisiana or Tampa, and you'll smell it. And now it's not just the oil. It's the chemicals that are being sprayed on the oil to break it up, to disperse it, to dissolve it, to sink it beneath the waves to the bottom of the sea, out of sight, out of mind. These chemicals are highly toxic. Some of them are methyl chlorides, which are rather benign at cold temperatures at best. But when you get them above 90 degrees, they have a tendency to volatilize, go gaseous, get into the air, and these are rather heavy compounds, so they don't float on up into the sky and disappear like chlorofluorocarbons did decades ago, which is why we don't use Freon in our air conditioners anymore. No, no, these hang down close to the ground like a blanket. You know, when there's a fire in your house, you wake up, you smell smoke, and it looks pretty thick, you're supposed to stop, drop, and roll, right? You're supposed to crawl out of the building. That's because these hot gases float to the top of the room, and there might be clean air at the bottom, or you can crawl out of your house without passing out, because it's mostly smoke inhalation that gets you before the flames ever take you. Not so with these chemicals. With these chemicals, they hug the ground like an invisible ground fog. And the closer to the ground you get, the more concentrated they are. In fact, if you're short, like a child or a baby that might be crawling on the floor, these are the individuals that will be affected the most. That child you're pushing along in the stroller will get a lungful while you never smell a thing walking it 5 or 6 feet off the ground. And we're not talking a small amount of chemicals. We're talking plane loads of chemicals. Recent clandestine flights over the Gulf of Mexico have scarcely shown a square mile that's not covered in thick auburn oil. It will be quite a while before this gets cleaned up. Now, the seas are pretty calm right now. We've had one tropical storm. But we're going to see more. We're going to see higher winds. And as those winds and storms and waves approach, that slick is going to break up. It's not going to go away. Yeah, it'll dehydrate a little bit. It'll be dissolved and it'll be diluted, as in most spills and most infiltrations into water systems. The solution is dilution, so they say. But in this case, it'll take a long time for this cleanup to occur. Now, it's a disaster, sure enough, and as we have explained before on this program, and as we did in the Veritas interview with Mel Fabregas, it was no accident. Yes, a disaster. But the events that led up to this spill were planned. Absolutely planned in advance, prepared for in advance. Now, there's some good and there's some bad to this. Now, I know you're apprehensive at first, but let me tell you what keeps us free, what keeps our planet clean, and what keeps the barons of energy from controlling our planet and every wire and every pipeline and every gas tank from their absolute control. And that's the press. That's us. And it's not so much the mainstream press. You know, they're weeks behind where internet news has been. Absolutely only when things are irrefutable and to the point where their listeners are clamoring for information, then and only then will they jump in and substantiate what has been said for weeks on internet news. However, the fact that this news can spread, the fact that factual testimony, film, and chemical analysis, and accurate tracking of money, and exposure of stock trades, and money changing hands, and insurance policies being increased, literally minutes, days, weeks before these events happen. This kind of exposure has created an atmosphere where these large companies cannot do what they want to do in the darkness. Why? Because we have turned the lights on. We're the ones that put the information out there in thousands of emails, hundreds of hours of testimony, blogs, videos, notes, chats spread all over the world. They can go nowhere without us watching. They can go nowhere without us taking action and speaking out. So I commend you, internet press, bloggers, witnesses, whistleblowers. I commend you for getting this information out there where we can get to it. I also commend you for not being so much the alarmists. There are some conditions that could get bad, very bad. Some people have called this an oil volcano. And true enough, it might be, as the formations that make up this oil underneath the Gulf of Mexico are old volcanic cavities that have filled with oil and gas. Now, this gas is at very high pressure. Those of you that have any doubts about this whatsoever must realize that the opening to this well is a mile underneath the water. That is about several hundred atmospheres of pressure. That's a lot of pressure. And the gas drive is so high that it's pushing the oil to the surface, even though there's that kind of pressure on top of this well. If that well were on the surface of the earth, it would have been a volcano. If it would have gotten away from drillers on the surface of the earth, that well would have decompressed under the ground, and the gas would, the liquid methane would have flashed to gaseous state. Those of you familiar with the supervolcano under Yosemite, there is a historical record of an ancient eruption of that supervolcano, ash as far away as the eastern side of Nebraska the last time that it blew. We have some prognostications, some predictions, some scientific speculation as to how stable the supervolcano is underneath Yosemite. Well, this is a volcano of that kind of magnitude sitting at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. Now, it's not one made of lava like you would see in lava and steam and poisonous gases like you would see underneath Yosemite. This one is oil and gas. But the principle is the same. Once it flashes the gas, it would literally blow the lid off of it, and you would not have one hole in the ground. You would have a crater in the ground. And the explosion would cause a tsunami a mere 90 miles off the coast. I can tell you, you'd have less than a minute to respond on shore. Now, fortunately, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. BP has made not really an announcement formally, but certainly in the press it has been reported that sometime tonight or early in the morning, that well is going to be capped. Now, we have thought for a while that it might be a smart idea to just plug the well, run a pipe down in the inside of the casing, and fill it full of concrete and call it plugged. But with $2 trillion worth of oil at the bottom of that hole, neither BP nor Transocean is open-minded to plugging that well. They want that well back. So there's a new cap being welded onto the top of that casing. I guess the casing has been cut off as of a couple of weeks ago. So they now have a nice square edge with which to put another cap on this well. It appears from the cutter, the robotic cutter that was on this well a couple of weeks ago, that they were cutting through the stainless steel bolts that held the two flanges together. If that's the case, if they were successful in cutting through those bolts, and we are just dealing with a flange sitting at the top of this casing, it is quite possible to settle another cap over that flange and rebolt another one into place. That triple lip ceiling between those two flanges will probably stop the oil leak. If there's a valve on this casing, then they can secure that valve and then go down and begin welding casing to it again and bring the drill pipe back to the surface and put that well back online sometime in the future. It might take a year, but that well could be salvaged. If that happens, and I suspect that it will, because there's a sizable amount of assets being put into this at this moment, then what you're going to see is the spill stopped, which means that the reporting about the spill is now going to shift to cleanup, and it's going to shift to litigation. Those fishermen, those people that were damaged financially and even health-wise, workers, their families, the drill crews that have been set aside, those lawsuits will begin. And believe me, there's going to be enough work for lawyers for 1,000 miles in every direction off this one. It will take 20 years before BP's attorneys fight off all the assailants and negotiate down the settlements, just like they did with Exxon Valdez. In the meantime, billions of dollars will be fed into cleanup operations, boom trucks, boom boats, pumping operations, maybe even new technology for recycling oil off the surface of salt water. And slowly but surely, the Gulf of Mexico will be returned to its crystal clear, pristine cleanliness, with the exception of that oil that was sent to the bottom of the sea. I imagine that those currents will be taking that oil deeper and deeper into the crevices of the deepest parts of the ocean. And someday soon, or someday in the distant future, the crustacean, lobster, and crab populations will return. In any case, what we will see is what we have always seen. when the batteries on the lights of the cameras wear out, the news will stop reporting and will go on to something else. Even if there are congressional investigations into this, and I suspect that there will be congressmen who will hang their hat on hanging somebody in industry out to dry, which industry will be more than happy to sacrifice, we will not pay any more attention to this once this well is capped. I would say in 12 months, we'll be on to the next disaster, the next ecological mistake that's made. The important thing here is that we, the people, have now been empowered. We have seen a path out of dependence upon oil. If the volatility of the price of oil was not enough, and believe me, if you don't think you had your effect with your outcries, you did. Had you not, we would be spending $4 a gallon for gasoline, make no mistake about it. But your outcries were so loud, and they were so heartfelt, and the economy hanging in the balance by a thread, just barely, barely above zero. In some cases, many places, not above zero. It was impossible for the oil companies to profiteer off of the price of gasoline. But it empowered us. It awakened us to the idea that there is and must be life after gasoline. One event that happened in the last week to 10 days was the initial public offering of Tesla Motors. Now, those of you that are familiar with the Tesla story, you could probably go on to something else for the next 2 minutes. Long story short, the founder and developer of PayPal. PayPal, for those of you who buy on the internet, is very familiar to you. Those that do not do it, you may not know what PayPal is. PayPal is, by all reports, the largest bank in the United States. It has over 80 million depositors. 80 million depositors. And zero buildings. Zero bank tellers. No real estate, no parking lots, no anytime tellers, nothing. No overhead whatsoever other than the machines it takes to electronically handle the money back and forth between your bank account at your bank and PayPal and between PayPal and the merchants. And PayPal takes 2.5% right off the top. Every single purchase. Billions and billions of dollars a week are spent on PayPal. And that's where the money came from. And so with $100 million that he made from the sale of PayPal, and believe me, I don't know this for a fact, but I would say, as a developer of PayPal, he probably kept a percentage or two. That's the money that started Tesla Motors. And since that time, he's been able to raise several $100 million more dollars, some of it through grants, like DEFOA 000070, which was a Bush loan guarantee that finally settled out, and also other grants and loan guarantees, as well as the Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Fund. Those of you that don't know what that fund is, very simply, $23.5 billion in loan guarantees, and they're fully funded, and they sit with none other than the Department of Energy. Yes, Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Fund. It is designed to fund manufacturing in high mileage or non-pollution vehicles, of which Tesla Motors would qualify. Qualify, yeah, that word. Well, as the Secretary of Energy would have it, only companies that have at least 1 to 2 years of profitable operation, that is to say, enough cash flow to be able to make the debt Those companies that could survive without the money, and I'm quoting right from the ATVM verbiage, are allowed to apply, which means all 11 of the American electric vehicle manufacturing companies, none of them qualify. Only Tesla Motors and one other company, Fisker Motors, only ones that qualify. Everyone else, Fit, Think, Phoenix, Zap, Vision, all those companies, none of them qualify for any money from the ATVM. And I have it on good report through my investigations directly by phone call a couple of weeks ago. I don't want to name my source because he is very high up and still plans to stay at work. All those funds have been earmarked for General Motors when they come out of bankruptcy. $23 billion. Nothing to small business the way Obama said it would be. So how does it happen? How do we make our way from addiction to the crude that floats on the Gulf of Mexico? How do we walk away from the pumps that line our highways from one end to the other? How, and by the way, I'm just floored. I couldn't believe my eyes the other night. Yes, when I'm not driving my electric vehicle around, I have to drive further than that, say 150 miles away, like going over to the plant in Kentucky. I have to drive my diesel-powered vehicle. Guess what I saw? You're not going to believe it. I know. You're not going to believe this. Hold on to your chairs. I saw people fueling up at BP. Yeah, I can't believe it. I saw people with gasoline hoses pouring BP gasoline right into their gas tanks. Can you believe it? It just blows my mind. Anyway, just thought I'd throw that in there. So the price has been pretty stable, and we have not been able to walk away from it. Because why? Not because we don't want to. Heavens, no. We haven't been able to walk away from it because there are no electric vehicles for sale in the United States. You can't find one. And if you're smart enough to drive your gasoline vehicle home, jerk that gasoline motor out from underneath the hood and slide an electric one under the hood and hide batteries in every nook and cranny in the vehicle, you could have an electric vehicle with a 20 or 30 mile range, which for most purposes is very suitable. And you could drive it for about $20 a month. But how many people have that skill level? Not many. Not many. I don't see very many out there. But you can't buy one. Nobody manufactures electric vehicles in the United States. If you want an electric vehicle, well, I'm afraid you're going to have to go to China or you're going to have to go to Korea. In fact, if you want to see an electric vehicle and not one, but thousands, tens of thousands, go to any major city you want in China and stand on any street corner and you will see thousands and thousands and thousands of electric motorcycles, scooters, cars, trucks. They're all over the place. Why? Because their government has made it easy for those vehicles to come to market in that country. And they're lowering their dependence upon oil in a big way, which is exactly where we should be going. But we're not. And not for lack of American ingenuity, not at all. There are 11 outstanding companies right here in the United States, small businesses, whose owners have poured millions of their own money and thousands of hours of their own time into building these companies from scratch. And how many of them deserve money from that ATVM fund? All of them. They all deserve that money. The 11 or 12 companies that have survived through the minefield and obstacle courses that the government has set up for such businesses, they should take that ATVM fund and they should divide it equally among them and give it to them. What would happen? Well, 80% of them would go broke because their technologies aren't any good, or because their marketing plans aren't any good, or just because they're poor business managers. But in the meantime, all that money goes to the local community. It hires local workers. It stimulates the building of houses and roads and stores and all kinds of satellite businesses on top of that. And 20% of those companies will succeed. That's right. Two or three or four of those electric car companies are going to make it. And the important thing is, there will be tens of thousands of electric vehicles per month hitting the road. Now, they won't have a General Motors sticker on them. They won't say Ford or Toyota or Hyundai. They might say Phoenix. They might say Fit or Fisker. They might have strange names on them. But they'll run and they'll work. And guess where you can charge them up, most of them? Anywhere you want. So, as you prepare yourself to graduate from this BP spill and all the scaremongering that's been going on surrounding it, and I can say that the scaremongering has been productive. It has made Americans awake and aware, except for those unbelievable folks that are still buying gas at BP. That just slays me. I can't believe it. There's a perfectly good Shell station right next door, and they were getting fuel at BP. Like, duh, like, what's going on? Are you even listening to the radio? Well, be that as it may, according to the Rasmussen poll in May of this year, 17% of Americans are ready. Yes, they're ready for the change. They're ready to add a plug-in electric vehicle to their driveway. They're ready to settle it into that little 8-foot-wide parking lot they have in front of their house or below their apartment. It's going to add to that gasoline-powered vehicle they think they can't live without. I'll tell you what happens. I know. When we place an electric vehicle on loan, give it to a family to drive for a month, I see what happens. I know what happens firsthand. They park that gasoline vehicle, and they don't drive it unless they absolutely have to. And here's what they discover. Sure enough, just like the Department of Transportation Household Survey has said for the last 10 years, most people on their personal trips drive 10.08 miles one way. For commercial trips, it's 28.6 miles one way. So when you ask yourself the question, how many of my trips could I make with an electric vehicle? The answer is all of them. All those trips to work, to the store, to the movies, four times on a Saturday to Lowe's, they can all be made with the electric vehicle. I've proven it. And you know what? It's fun. Because while you get to pull in to that convenience store and buy milk and a Snickers bar or a Pepsi and Doritos, guess what you get to do? You get to walk out, get in your vehicle, and drive away without buying any gas. And it's kind of fun to watch other consumers tethered to that little black hose and that credit card reader out there that feeds billions of dollars every quarter into the pockets of foreign oil companies. You get to drive right by them, because every single electron that goes in your vehicle that fuels you to that store, to the movies, to the mall, to the soccer game, is American-made. Every electron creates American jobs. And if you were to invest or buy a vehicle from one of these American companies, guess where the profits stay? You guessed it. Right here in America. Yes, some of the raw materials might be bought overseas. Car frames, wheels, electrical parts, windshield parts, seat belts, seats, all kinds of things. But the vast majority of the money and the profits would stay right here in small town America. Now, there's a way to make this happen. We'll discuss that a little further as we get into the program. But I want you to make sure that you are invited here at X Squared Radio, 415-762-1161. Anywhere on planet or off planet, we have a lot of listeners in Australia and Wales. I know it's off hours for you guys. We're live 5 to 8 Pacific time. But this is important. Hearing your voice here on the radio, going out to hundreds of thousands of listeners live, because I know you're out there, or millions of listeners as they go back and listen to these archives, it has its effect. I know this because I was at the eSETI conference this last weekend. And did I mention it was a sellout? Yeah, it was a sellout. Pretty amazing to see. Do you know how many of those people listened to the BBS radio network? A lot of them. Hundreds of them. And many of them listened to this program right here, X Squared Radio. We're proud to be members of this network. We're proud to reach those people that are awake, aware, and use their money, their buying power, to make things happen in this genre. So, as we move forward, and you get ready for the news, trust me, watch the news in the morning. If you watch network news, well, shame on you. But if you watch cable news, well, shame on you too. But pay attention, because the commercials, the music, the actors, the CGI, all of the wonderful flowers and waving fields of grain and clean ocean waves have all been pre-recorded. The productions are ready and waiting to wow you with the wonderful efforts the oil companies are making to make it a cleaner, better planet. Now that the spill is plugged, oh, yes, it was an unfortunate tragedy, but those days are behind us, and we're implementing new safety measures, and we'll never let this happen again. So please, if you read the small print, shut up and go buy some more gas. So as we progress forward, I want you to be aware you're being manipulated. As slick and nice as a wonderful television program, Wild America. No, that's Marty Stauffer. Good God, by the way. You're going to be sold. You're going to be manipulated with propaganda that's designed to tell you everything's okay. Everything's under control. You can go back to sleep now. I doubt it. You are all awake, and you're not going to go back to sleep. Ever vigilant you shall be, and focused you will be on freedom. What kind of freedom? Freedom from using gasoline to go back and forth to work. Work. That's another thing. Where are we with respect to finding jobs? You know, it's kind of interesting. If you put your shingle out there, you got your resume, a little bit of work experience, you put it on Monster. There were days in the past when you had 5 or 6 phone calls a day, certainly a week for work, because they were trying to find quality people to work here or work there. People that were willing. People that were skilled. People that were able to do stuff and believe in something and work for it. But those fields of abundance have about dried up. You go to Monster now, instead of seeing 40, 50, 60 jobs that have been posted in the last 7 days, you might see 3 or 4. And those jobs are fake. If you apply, half the time, well, more than half the time, you're going to get an email that says, that job's already been filled, but we'll keep your resume on record, and should something come up, we'll give you a call. And the other half of the time, or maybe a little more than half of the time, you're going to get emails asking you to become insurance salesman, or you're going to be an industrial salesman, commission only, of course, which means you spend your money, your time, your gas, and you go sell their product. And if you should happen to be successful, they'll pay you a commission. Yeah, you'll see how that works. I'm not trying to be cynical here, but I'm cynical. And then there are the leaders. The leaders that have to go to work every day and realize they don't have the workforces that they need. Sometimes they have too many workers and they can't get rid of them because it breaks their heart. Because if they get rid of them, the community in which they live will founder. The schools will close. City workers will be laid off. School administrators will be put on furlough. We can't have that. And so they struggle on. Those leaders live a lonely life because they're being beaten up by the shareholders and they're also being beaten up by the workers, by that failure to look them in the eye. And lastly, we have the entrepreneur, the Unternehmer-Eigenschaft. This is the driver. These are the people that have joined the ranks of the unemployed, voluntarily or unvoluntarily, involuntarily. These are the people that have the ideas. These are the people that have the belief, that wake up before dawn and begin work, and they work and they fall asleep at their computer. And then they wake up in the middle of the night to make sure that every email, every Facebook message, every Twitter, every possible lead is answered. Why? Because they want to be successful. And whether they're running a hair salon or they're cutting grass or painting houses or working on cars in their garage, or whether they have an idea for a mall kiosk or a restaurant or a service industry or some software that they've written, they're driven and they drive themselves awake every morning. And as they eat standing up, they have the energy to push themselves to think of one more way that they can take their business to the next level. One more way that can provide a job for someone. Another way that they can spread the value of their business to more and more people. That's the drive of America. That's the drive of planet Earth. And it's that independence, it's that will to be free, to be in control of your own paycheck, to never, ever experience being called to the front office and fired ever again. Oh, you could fire yourself 3 times a day. I fire myself at least once a week, then rehire myself at lesser pay under worse conditions. But I still get up every day. I still do it every day. I still believe in what I'm doing and work hard every day till the wee hours of the morning, as does every entrepreneur in this country. Everyone who wants to be free, everyone who has a dream and is working toward that dream. That's why we will survive. That's why the human race is not lost. Because that drive cannot be squelched. It cannot be kept down. And yes, we're jerking at the chain and the cable, trying to break free from that little wire that runs down our street that feeds electricity into our houses. Yes, we're trying to break free of that black hose that connects the pumps to our vehicles. Yes, we're trying to break free from the grid of energy that holds us captive. And even while electric vehicles are being perfected and shown off and rumored to be starting this date or that date, the craft behind it, or should I say the craftiness behind it, is seeking to keep the battery out of your possession. No, they want to have a network of batteries. They want to have a network, a charging grid. That's what we need. Yeah. And that way, even though you own the electric car, you gotta pay for the minutes to drive it. And they control the price. They control the plug. They control the voltage that goes into your car. They control the cities where you can live and cannot live with your electric vehicle. But there are some out there that have created electric vehicles that will run and plug in anywhere. Any wall socket, any dryer plug, the one in your garage, the one that's used for the oil heaters out in front of the Piggly Wiggly Market. Every outlet can be used, no special charging grid required. And those vehicle companies are out there. Those companies will give you the freedom. And if you're smart enough and entrepreneurial enough to have some kind of wind energy or solar energy or hydrogen energy or geothermal energy or natural gas that might be on your property that runs a small generator, you could charge your car up with your own power. And if we ever get solar cells to come down in price, maybe solar cells can be placed on top of the vehicles, and every 5 days you can drive it for a day and you never have to plug it in. And somewhere out there, somewhere in someone's attic or someone's basement or someone's garage or their spare office, there is charge as you drive technology sitting on the bench. All it needs is a vehicle to go in. And now you have a way to charge up the batteries without connecting to anything. Ha ha. And there are claims out there of devices that will actually run a car, but come on, I'm a physicist. I'm not a believer in anything. Bring me one. We'll test it. If it works, let's make a million of them. Let's get ourselves off this grid. Now, just a couple of commercials really quick. Remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel, we have been waiting and waiting and waiting for the publisher. One excuse after another. Those of you that have published books know exactly what I'm talking about. I think finally we have come to the end of the excuses, and we're going to see the book in print very soon. We're expecting the galley copy this week. And if we get the galley copy this week and that looks good, we will approve it and it will go to the printer, and then you will be able to buy your copy. Now, this book's going to come out around $15, so it's very affordable. It's going to be in hard copy and paperback, available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere where books are sold. However, if you want an autographed copy, and more especially if you want that audio version to go with it, you're going to have to go to the website. The website is rememberingthefuturebook.com. Rememberingthefuturebook.com. There is a 4-hour workshop that goes with this book. The DVD is available, and we'll be happy to get that to you. You have to click on the online shop at X Squared Radio in order to get to that. We will cross-link that to Remembering the Future so that you can get your hands on it. It's a good workshop. Teaches you the tools that you need to turn the law of attraction on for you and make it work. We'll take a short break, about 3 minutes, 40 seconds. Relax a little bit. Relax. We're heading into the second hour of X Squared Radio. Be right back. Thank you. Girard off the Varenza album. Patrick Cassidy helping her out there. NASA warns solar flares from huge space storm will cause devastation. Britain could face widespread power blackouts and be left without critical communication signals for long periods of time after the Earth is hit by a once-in-a-generation space storm, NASA has warned. National power grids could overheat and air travel severely disrupted, while electronic items, navigation devices, and major satellites could stop working after the sun reaches its maximum power in a few years. As you know, solar cycle 24 just began, and it has been slowly, ever so slowly, increasing in severity. The new Solar Dynamics Observatory is giving us almost play-by-play views of the sun from an amazing angle. Senior space agency scientists believe the Earth will be hit with unprecedented levels of magnetic energy from solar flares after the sun awakens from a deep slumber sometime around 2013, the Daily Telegraph can disclose. In a new warning, NASA said the superstorm would likely hit like a bolt of lightning and could cause catastrophic consequences for the world's health, emergency services, and national security unless precautions are taken. Scientists believe it could damage everything from emergency services systems, hospital equipment, banking systems, and air traffic control devices through to everyday items such as home computers, iPods, satellite navigation systems. Due to humans' heavy reliance on electronic devices which are sensitive to magnetic energy, the storm could leave a multi-billion-dollar damage bill and potentially devastate governments. We know it is coming, but we don't know how bad it's going to be, says Dr. Richard Fisher, the director of NASA's Heliophysics Division, said in a new interview with the Daily Telegraph. He goes on, it will disrupt communication devices such as satellite and car navigations, air travel, banking systems, blah, blah, blah. Large areas will be without electricity and will not be able to repair the damage, as it may take some time to replace all those microprocessors. He said large swaths of the world could face being without power for several months, although he admitted that was unlikely. These could be isolated areas rather than large city areas. A more likely scenario was that large areas, including Northern Europe and Britain, which have fragile power grids compared to the United States, would be without power and access to electronic devices for hours, possibly even days, which really could be devastating for surveillance, and we don't know what kind of advantage could be taken of that. The bottom line is that you need to be prepared. And our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com, Paul Faust, really has a good setup there. If you get a chance and you're cruising the web and you've got a couple extra dollars after, of course, investing in that local electric car company, then you can go to 1-800-PREPARE.com and you can get what you need, a 72-hour kit or a month's supply for a family of four. These kinds of items are sold in packages that can last for up to 25 years. So once you have it, you have a sense of security. If the power goes out, you've got a way to eat. You've got a way to filter water. You are not going to be a burden upon the other emergency preparedness services out there. So take a little responsibility. Listen to the news. We know that it's coming. We've got experts telling us that it's coming. The SDO is watching it. Even now, Sunspot 1087 is preparing to whack the Earth with a solar flare. So if you don't think that we rely heavily upon microelectronic communication, take a look around next time you're on the freeway and tell me how many people you see talking on the cell phone. Imagine how business would come to an absolute standstill if there was no cell phone communication. Yeah, even I would be out of business. Also, I wanted to let you know that it has been discovered that the first humans arriving in Britain didn't happen in 6,000 years ago or even 10,000 years ago. 250,000 years earlier than thought. That's right. Archaeologists digging on a Norfolk beach found stone tools that show the first humans were living in Britain much earlier than previously thought. Archaeologists explain how flint tools and other artifacts found on the Norfolk coast reflect how the first Britons lived. A spectacular haul of ancient flint tools has been recovered from a beach in Norfolk, pushing back the date of the first known human occupation of Britain by up to 250,000 years. While digging along the northeast coast of East Anglia, near the village of Happisburg, archaeologists discovered 78 pieces of razor-sharp, flint-shaped into primitive cutting and piercing tools. The stone tools were unearthed from sediments that are thought to have been laid down either 840,000 years or 950,000 years ago, making them the oldest human artifacts ever found in Britain. The flints were probably left by hunter-gatherers who eked out a living on the floodplains and marshes that bordered an ancient course of the River Thames that has long since dried up. The flints were then washed downriver and came to rest at the Happisburg site. The early Britons would have lived alongside saber-toothed cats and hyenas, primitive horses, red deer, and southern mammoths in a climate similar to that of southern Britain today, though winters were typically a few degrees colder. These tools from Happisburg are absolutely mint fresh. They are exceptionally sharp, which suggests they have not moved far from where they were dropped. These people probably used the rivers as routes into the landscape. A lot of Britons might have been heavily forested at the time, which would have posed a major problem for humans without strong axes to chop down trees. They lived out in the open, but we don't know if they had basic clothing, were building primitive shelters, or even had the use of fire. I suspect they did have the use of fire. The discovery reported in the journal Nature overturns the long-held belief that early humans steered clear of chilly Britain and the rest of northern Europe in favor of the more hospitable climates of the Mediterranean. The only human species known to be living in Europe in the time is Homo antecessor, or pioneer man, whose remains were discovered in the Antapurca Hills of Spain in 2008 and have been dated to date between 1 million and 1.2 million years old. The early settlers would have walked into Britain across an ancient land bridge that once divided the North Sea from the Atlantic and connected the country to what is now mainland Europe across the English Channel. The first humans probably arrived during a warm interglacial period, but may have retreated as temperatures plummeted in subsequent ice ages. Still, that pushes human activity in Europe far further into history than we once suspected. Very interesting stuff. You can learn a lot about this kind of stuff and more by picking up the Ark of Millions of Years series. Those of you that have copies of them, tell a friend about them, because Volume 4 is about to come out. If you want to learn more, and by the way, there is still a special going on with that book, and with that series of books. It's about 1,500 pages, the first three volumes. If you go to arkofmillionsofyears.com, that's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, arkofmillionsofyears.com, and you purchase the books from that website, you will receive the first two volumes of the books in audio for free. They come as downloads with your PayPal receipt. When volume 4 comes out, we will catch up and have volume 3 in audio. So ArcOfMillionsOfYears.com, pick those up. They're available in, as a trilogy at a special price, one shipping fee for all three books. So you go there, pick those books up. They make excellent, excellent birthday presents for those that want to know what's coming up with 2012, why are we here, where did we come from, what's the origin and destiny of the Earth, and what about these ancient civilizations going back 25,000 years and more? We're not talking about cave dwellers now. We're talking about major civilizations with major zeniths of engineering and socioeconomic structure. This hour, and by the way, if you want to be part of the program, the phone number is 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. Those of you that attended the eSETI conference, we welcome you. If you want to call in, talk about your experience there. Had a wonderful time being there. We'd love to hear from you. What I'm going to go over right now is a theory that some have had that we, or I, talk about in some depth in the new book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. If you want to pick up a copy of that, you need to go to rememberingthefuturebook.com. The ebook is out now. It's $7.95. It's about 200 pages, pretty easy read. It is a crossover book between self-help and New Age. It's a very, it fills a niche in the self-help genre. And it links together some things that were missing, you know, as Rhonda Byrne wrote the book, The Secret, and it enjoyed a wonderful marketing plan. Some 100,000 copies were given away to realtors all over the nation, inspiring them to become better real estate salesmen, and eventually Oprah got a hold of it, and, well, the rest is marketing history. And as the book went out there and sold millions of copies, of course, millions of people ran out and got a new pair of scissors and their favorite magazines, and they went to work covering their refrigerator doors. And then a marvelous thing happened. Nothing. Because although the idea did hit on something called the law of attraction, this idea of focusing upon those things that you want to have or that you want to be or that you want to do, that energy has to be focused in an organized way. The tools for doing it were missing. And that's why Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, was written, because the tool was discovered. That's right. And it's in the book, and it is a marvelous mathematical discovery that we relate to the focusing of energy in a patterned way so that you can make the law of attraction work for you. And the other thing that we discovered as we were doing our research for the book is that it's quite possible that the Big Bang never happened. You see, the arrow of time is a ray we measure in terms of distance. When we talk about the speed of light, we talk about 186,000 miles per second, or 300,000 meters per second, or we talk about parsecs, or we talk about lunar distances or solar distances. Arrow of time is a ray we measure in terms of distance. It is the human being who believes he alone occupies the zero point. We now know that the universe is the mathematical sum of the consciousness of all the sentient beings in it. I have just been texted a note, a question from a listener. Have you discussed the eSETI experiment and what you did with the group and John Riley with his device called consciousness. Hmm. Very interesting. Yes. Before we get too much into the arrow of time and the idea that the Big Bang never happened, we did, in fact, perform an experiment at the ESETI conference. And it was rather remarkable, because what we discovered a year before, we had set up a piece of equipment that John Riley invented. He is the owner of Zero Point Research, which is a Santa Monica-based technology company. John Riley comes from a stellar young career at Lockheed Skunk Works, where he rose quickly in the ranks, and after nearly a decade, left Lockheed and became a special effects builder for the movie industry. And this is before the days of CGI, where you could just about create anything or anyone you want on a computer. This is back when special effects were really special effects. And in doing this, as an entrepreneur, he also ran a small DVD duplication and publication company. These were artists and lecturers who had developed DVD films, did not have the duplicating equipment and packaging equipment that was necessary to mass produce these things. And so John built a small factory that produces these things. And one of the researchers that gave him a DVD to produce was none other than William Henry. You've heard William Henry on this program, in fact. If you haven't, you need to go back into the archives and listen to it again. It goes all the way back to the year 2005 or 2006 on X Squared Radio. He is an Egyptian mythologist and an amazing researcher with unmatched resources in this area of research. One of the things that William Henry discovered inside of Abydos, in two places on the wall, was a very strange device, which he calls the Isis-Osiris device. Now, as you know, or you may have seen on Discovery Channel, History Channel, and National Geographic Channel, Egyptian hieroglyphs and pictures and bas-reliefs are on in two dimensions, complete with the feet both pointing in the same direction. You know, those funny drawings, although extremely well detailed in stone. One of those devices tickled the fascination of William Henry, and so he produced a video on it, and it got into the hands of Lockheed Skunk Works special effects expert John Riley, and he looked at this, and he looked at it again, and of course it was just a two-dimensional image. And something triggered inside of him, and he said, you know what, I've got to see this in three dimensions. And so he got with William Henry and got with a graphic artist, and so they did a perspective drawing of what this device might have looked like. Still, there were some pieces that were flat, that were square, because they were square when you look at them from the front. But ancient technology has a way of awakening things inside of us. And one of the things John realized is this was no ordinary device. This was a high-voltage resonator. And so John dug up some very old technology, almost 100 years old, been sitting in wax paper for nearly a century. And after he finished his design, he had created what the world now knows as the life stream generator. This is a very high voltage, slowly rotating DC magnetic field. As luck would have it, or design, inspiration, the microcircuitry of this device allows this magnetic field to rotate at a frequency of around 7.8 hertz. I'm not sure exactly because I'm not privy to that information. But it is conducive to biological systems. It is not an AC field. We're not talking about a giant AC coil plugged into the wall here. This is a rotating DC magnetic field, high voltage, and what happened when this device was built was an amazing thing. Discoveries that biological systems responded very favorably to this field. Increases in mental cognizance, in optical performance, memory. In fact, cells began to rejuvenate and began to resist signs of aging. Now, we can't make any clinical claims, and we don't. This is just a plain old energy experience. But a large one was built called consciousness. It generates somewhere around 4.4 million volts. And it was set up in the field of a known active area in Trout Lake, Washington. Now, before this point, the entire area was, of course, energized. Lots of orbs, lots of ships, lots of awakenings and healings and all kinds of things on this ancient Indian property. But when consciousness was set up a year ago and turned on, it opened a vortex. When we returned this year, out in the field, constructed like almost an open fenced-in area, was the location of the vortex. It had been validated. So again this year, this device was set up out in the field at the base of Mount Adams under the stars of Southern Washington State. And when it was turned on this time, over 200 people were connected to it in a large circle. We started with about 180, and over the next 20 or 30 minutes, 15 or 20 more people filtered in and filled in the circle. I estimate there were just over 200 people in that circle. This time, the result was nothing short of spectacular. The orbs that came in were so plentiful that when people were snapping pictures, you almost couldn't see the people for the orbs. They were so thick. And those were the people that were snapping pictures. When you put on the infrared, and I'm not talking about the green Generation 3 night vision goggles. I'm talking about infrared goggles. And you took the infrared spotlight and shined it over the heads of these people surrounding this vortex connected to this rotating magnetic field that now connected all of them together in a circle that was probably over 100 feet in diameter. What you saw was a veritable ocean, an ocean of orbs swimming over the heads of these people. And now, these are reported to be ethereal life forms, maybe either very primitive or very advanced life forms. Maybe they were here before humans, and they will be here long after humans. But they interact with humans. They interact with the joviality of humans. If the mood is very lighthearted and very song-worthy, then these orbs react. They interact. They come in. They congregate around this kind of emotion, around this kind of energy, this human consciousness. And they're visible. They are visible. This is the energy that the Tibetan monks speak of when pilgrims visit their temples. Of course, the monks are in a state of meditation. They're in a state of purity when it comes to their diet and their lifestyle and their absence of noise in their minds. They're able to see these higher beings, these orbs floating around. In some temples, and you can find this if you look at the video on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, there are some clips that I filmed in Tibet. You will see these orbs hanging from ordinary fishing line in the form of Christmas ornaments, glass balls hanging from the ceiling. When I investigated and I asked my guide to ask those Tibetan monks what these things were, after a couple of inquiries, it came back, well, they're orbs. They're therefore the dimensionally blind. When the pilgrim makes his way, knees to feet to hands to knees to feet to hands, from where he lives in Tibet to Lhasa, to these temples, sometimes they're dimensionally blind. They're focused on some illness at home or some lack of abundance in their tent or their hovel or their home. And they come there to the temple to seek solace for that, some support from that, from Maitreya or from Buddha or from the other icons in Tibetan Buddhism. And hanging from the ceiling are these balls to give them hope that the masters are there, floating in the air above them, watching over them. But when you have the right energy and you have the right mindset, the right consciousness, and in our case, the right equipment, you can see these orbs coming in and interacting with the people. It was life-changing for many people in that circle. There were healings in that circle. There were people that went home never to be the same. And they're awake. And they are affecting the universe as we speak. And that was the experiment that was conducted at Trout Lake, Washington, with consciousness, a device built by Zero Point Research at the hands of John Riley. His website, zeropointresearch.com, if you want to research that for yourself. Some of the photos, and I believe some of the video is being posted as we speak so that you can look at that yourself. And that is, if you have any questions about that, I'd be happy to discuss it with you. It's 415-762-1161, and we greatly appreciate our listeners who text in, and we also appreciate our listeners who call in. And there were some great stories. You know, we have Diane in Michigan who doesn't fly anymore, but she does drive. And so they took off in their car from Michigan to Washington, and they broke down twice. Two fuel pumps on the way to Washington. Still, they arrived in a rental car. Nothing could stop them from reaching the eCity conference this year. And we're so glad that listeners of X Squared Radio made that trip. We're thankful that they came, and we're thankful to have met them face-to-face. We sat around a make-believe fire. No fires there. Trying to keep the skies dark and our pupils nice and wide open. But we did some drumming, and it was cold, people. It was in the high 40s there. So record cold all across the West. Going back to 1926, those temperatures have not been met. Now, whether these beings are awake, asleep, conscious, unconscious, or just not conscious, they're conscious. They are affecting the consciousness of the universe. That's why we have these conferences, so that we can wake them up, so that we can make them conscious that they're conscious. They become self-aware, and like gods in the middle of the void, they wake up and they say, "I am." And once they become self-aware, they realize that they're in control of their own life condition. And you watch them go off, able to fish for themselves, changing the universe as they go, no longer having to be fed, but feeding all those around them. Now, it can be said that the larger the population, statistically, the more stable the average value is. Any statistician knows this. That may be the case with a population made of individual samples, like marbles or M&Ms, that never change in value. But sentient beings change all the time. Sometimes through infinitesimal stimuli, and sometimes through major ascension experiences. They oscillate. They vacillate. They are social beings who tend to coagulate into small groups around tribal campfires, chanting similar ideas. When the range of ideas inside a group gets too large, or when they become too dissimilar, then new groups form, subgroups. Thus, the average consciousness of the universe is shifting through the average of the averages. We call this X double bar. Sometimes only a few units, and sometimes, especially after a major event, such as a revival or a mass awakening or a war or tragedy of some kind, they shift a lot. The Big Bang is most widely accepted these days as the method by which the universe came into being. All the matter in the universe was packed into one singularity, which is theorized to have formed through the collapse of everything in the universe into one spot. Sort of like a giant inhale. The universe drew all energy and matter into a single one-dimensional dot. Or, if you want to look at it the way the book Gravitation looks at it, it was a giant exhale, letting everything out of the balloon so that all the galaxies collapse into one wrinkled singularity in the middle of the void. Of course, conservation of momentum would demand that the larger diameter universe, rotating at a very slow rate, would spin faster and faster as it collapsed, like an ice skater drawing her arms in as she spins. This would mean that the universe would be spinning at its maximum speed possible, given its mass, which for all intents and purposes is finite. The singularity would be a possibility only. That is to say, locating the singularity inside the event horizon and defining its speed would obey a Heisenberg uncertainty. This is a probability of its existence rather than a pure center of the massive black hole universe. Spinning would change its shape by way of the uncertainty, which would result in a universe that looks a little bit like a giant donut. The probability itself would create an opportunity for what we call a Higgs event. It's sort of acting like Velcro crumpled up. The uniformity of energy throughout the black hole would be highly improbable. Somewhere, a snag occurred, and then boom, or rather, bang. The universe was born as the ice skater spun so fast she exploded on global television, and within microseconds, energy was collapsing into matter we see as stars and galaxies and planets. This is the perspective of human scientists. Humanism is the basis for these assumptions. Picture a measuring cup in a sink under a dripping faucet. It would be easy to count the number of drops per minute, measure the water in the measuring cup, and then predict the amount of time the cup has been sitting under the faucet, right? After all, the conditions that were working to fill the cup were stable. Therefore, it is reasonable to make this judgment. That's humanism. The way things are is the way they have always been, so we can extrapolate back to the beginning or to the future to make assumptions. Wrong. You see, in reality, someone placed the measuring cup in the sink, turned on the faucet for a few seconds, shut it off, and left it dripping just a few moments before you entered the kitchen. The cup has only been sitting there for less than a minute. This is catastrophism. Human consciousness is like the hand on the faucet, making catastrophic changes to the universe. We do it all the time. But, according to modern science, Earth is once again the center of the universe. Or was that the church that made that claim? Oh, well, I guess there's not much difference, is there? I would like to propose a different analysis here. Consider the photon. Just an ordinary photon. When an electron associated with a shell of energy around an atom or a molecule falls from a higher state to a lower energy state, a photon of very specific frequency is emitted. This spectrum is so precise that we can determine the exact identity of the atom or molecular bond, single, double, or triple, and between which two atoms by plotting against time. We can determine that spectrum. Most stars generate spectra in the oxygen, carbon, or nitrogen species. However, when one looks into the night sky and discovers For only a moment, the distance between the star and the detector, in our case the human eye, an amazing realization comes forth. Arcturus is 36.7 light years from Earth, and is nearly the same size as our Sun. This means that its light travels as fast as it can for nearly 40 years to reach your eye at night. Well, that's from a human perspective. From the perspective of the photon itself, it left the electron shell of its birth and instantly arrived at your eye. There is no path 40 light years long, weaving through gravitational fields and dodging particles through space to get to your eye, not from the perspective of the photon. Impossible, you say? Well, let's think about the math for a second. Let's look at Einstein's very simple little formula, E is equal to mc squared. Energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared. And what was the speed of light? We talked about that in the first part of this hour. 300,000 meters per second. Oh, wait a minute. Let's express that whole thing while doing all the terms. Energy is equal to mass times 300,000 meters per second squared. Now we can consider all the values in this household equation. Remember, we're the photon here. We're traveling at the speed of light, and time slows down at the speed of light. In fact, mass becomes infinity, right? Well, let's look at it another way before we do all the math. Time becomes zero, or at least very, very small. That's right. Time becomes zero. Very, very small. Oh, yes, one of my textures says 300,000 kilometers per second. It's not 300,000 meters. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm talking here. I'm talking. So I got to keep my metrics straight. Thanks very much, listeners. I appreciate that. Time becomes zero in the bottom of that fraction, or very close to it. So when you divide that into 300,000 kilometers squared, well, you get a very, very big number. But if it's zero, then you get an irrational number, an illegitimate number in mass, energy, everything goes to zero. Wait a minute. Energy goes to zero? How can that happen? Energy can't be created or destroyed. How does that happen? Well, in case the impact of this realization didn't sink in the first time, this is exactly what we would see from outside our own universe. The Hamiltonian of the universe is the potential energy plus the kinetic energy, which equals zero. You don't have to do the math, just trust me. We're talking about looking at the universe from outside the universe, like we're looking at a big bubble. That means we hypothetically step outside relativity, where everything in the universe can be explained only in terms of other things inside the universe. Time is really distance at the speed of light. Since the set of energy in the universe is fixed, there cannot be an infinite resolution. Let me say that one more time. Since the set of energy in the universe is fixed, there cannot be an infinite resolution. That means you can have a ruler that measures in 16ths, in 32nds, in 64ths, and keep dividing and dividing and dividing until you get down to the smallest possible distance, which is a Planck length, but you have reached the limit. And if you have reached a finite ability to resolve, then the universe is finite. If we can consider the universe from outside the universe, which mathematicians do all the time, and we just did it right there, then we can observe the entire thing at one time. That's right. That means that the entire universe is now. And speaking of now, Mark from Ohio is on line two. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Hey, Doctor. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. It's been a good week of rest and challenge. and I really enjoyed it. But it's good to be back before the microphone.
How did you like the conference?
Well, I loved it. In a word, the conference is neat because you get to be exposed to all these great speakers: William Henry, Alfred Lambermont Weber. We had Shelley Yates there this year. We had several lecturers that talked about experiencing UFO activity and alien activity. And some of it was a little scattered, but that's to be expected, you know, when you get up and speak in front of people. And the presentations were phenomenal. And I got to say, James Gilliland has finally got a venue that he dreamed about. And it's taken many years for that thing to really develop. But as far out of the way as that place is up in the foothills of Mount Adams, it has really become a mecca. And people should make that trip at least once in their lifetime. It's really an amazing place.
I flew into Portland in the evening before the conference. And you know, my paranormal experience started descending into Portland and seeing that tremendous cloud cover that goes for hundreds of miles. Did you fly into Portland?
Yeah, I flew into Portland, and it was chilly. And we took the drive up to... up to East Eddy. There's a car full of us. And when we got there, there wasn't going to be any stargazing that night, that's for sure. But, interestingly enough, we got out around the fire pit, which did not have a fire in it, by the way. Wednesday night was the final night of fires up there. We got up there Thursday night. We sat around the pit drumming. I've never done this before. I mean, I can keep a rhythm as good as anybody, I guess, but there were some really talented drummers, and it wasn't just 20 minutes. It was like an hour of drumming, and as we were drumming, we manifested a clearing in those clouds, and we got to stargaze, and sure enough, ships came over through this opening, which opened up only over us. Cloud cover everywhere else across the southern part of the state and Oregon, but right there, it was clear. For the period of time that we were drumming.
That's incredible. You know, I stayed up at Hood River, so I drove up I-84 East that evening all the way up to a hotel called the Columbia Gorge Hotel. And I don't know if you ever seen the Columbia Gorge area, but I stayed up on a cliff there, and it's beautiful. That gorge is, I think, about 80 miles long, and those mountains are about 4,000 feet high in some places there. It was a tremendous view. And then the next day, driving into Trout Lake, I think it's WA-141 there. It winds for about 20 miles near the Salmon River, and that's some of the most beautiful country that I've ever seen. Anywhere, I think there's some kind of national scenic area there. It's just absolutely hard to describe unless you actually go there. You see these dense pine forests with the trees 70 and 80 feet high. And then when you get there on the ranch, you see Mount Adams, and it's so massive, it's haunting, and yet it's gorgeous at the same time. So I had a spiritual experience just from the countryside. But that's before I met anybody or saw any ships or anything.
First time I visited up there, you're winding and you're kind of blocked from the view by the tremendous forests. But then you come into a straightaway and bang, there's Mount Adams right in front of you, all covered with snow. And it's really breathtaking.
And you know, the people, I've never met so many people that were just so positive. It was really hard to describe, because you meet someone casually and the next thing you know, you're in a deep conversation with them and you feel like you've known them for a long, long period of time. And I got to meet Paula Harris, and I think I talked to her for 15 or 20 minutes, and her presentation I thought was just tremendous. That was probably my favorite one.
What a wealth of
knowledge. I don't know if you remember Etook, the man that gave the prayer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to sit down and talk to him for a while. Did you get to meet him?
Oh, sure. Yeah, he runs the Arctic Research Center up at Barrow, Alaska. And he's quite an activist. He's very energetic, and he knows what's going on with the environment.
Well, I tell you what, I've met some great friends there, and I'm going to try to stay in touch with him and try to go back again. It almost feels like home there. I can't quite explain it, and I'm glad that you're telling people about this, and you were a major reason that I finally decided to go, and I thank you, and I think James is doing a tremendous thing, and I think it may play a role maybe in helping to improve our society. It just seems like with that much positive intention, those people have to have some kind of impact, I would hope anyway.
Yeah, that's what I get too, that people leave there with a life-changing experience, and they take it home with them, and then they affect the place they work and where they live, and it has its effect, I promise you. All corners of the earth are being affected right there at Trout Lake. And people come from all over, from Australia, New Zealand, England. We've had people there from Japan. It's really phenomenal.
Well, thanks, Dr. Agnew. It was a pleasure being there. It was a pleasure meeting you, and have a good evening.
All right. Thanks very much for calling, Mark. All right, we have Diane from Michigan. She had to get herself there, a couple of breakdowns in her car, and then finally a rental car, and then she ended up making it. And she had a wonderful time, and it was a joy meeting her and hearing her story and feeling her energy. What a great influence she is. So as we're discussing this great effect that we have, or as we look at this big bang that may have never happened, we look at the universe from the speed of the photon, and the whole entire universe collapses into a singularity. In other words, the big bang never happened. Merely being the photon gives us access to all distance, which is all time, which is all local. And this is consistent with the ancient scriptures as well. God is omnipresent, seeing past, present, and future all at once. It seems the only challenge here is speeding yourself up to match the speed of the photon. Aha, yeah, we can do that. Empirically, we have seen thought move many times the speed of light. So speeding up our consciousness to the speed of light should be no more difficult than jogging around the park. That's easy for an awakened being. It is quickly being confirmed by the physics community that consciousness is integrally involved in the creation of the universe. I know that's a big statement, but there are some constants missing when we put together all of the energy. When we put together, for instance, looking at the universe from our telescopes, we see all the stuff that lights up. That's the easy part. And we're beginning to pick up the planets that perturb the stars out there. We've got the Kepler probe out there identifying hundreds of planets as we go. And there may be a billion Earths in our galaxy. But there's still a lot more mass that's unaccounted for, a lot more energy that's unaccounted for based on the movement and the energy that we see in the universe. So that we affectionately call dark matter and dark energy. Why do we call it dark matter and dark energy? Well, it's kind of an inherited term. But again, it's homocentric. That is to say, we have a tendency to say, yep, once again, Earth is the center of the universe. It's dark because we can't see it. But could be something else. We'll find out in a minute, because now Diane is back. Welcome to the program, Diane.
Good evening, Bruce.
Good evening, Bruce.
Brooke, I just wanted to call and thank you for being there and for meeting you and Robin again. And by the way, we broke down three times. Two with the fuel pump and one with the sensor. It wasn't the fuel pump at all.
Oh,
but everything worked out beautifully, and I wanted to talk about the...
How did the car do going home?
Great. Not a problem. I mean, okay. I was all set for flat tires. I had everything all set for anything that possibly could have gone wrong except for the fuel pump, which it wasn't the fuel pump. But the dealer took care of it beautifully, and then I have to deal with the other two on my own accord here. But the conference was just fantastic, even though I missed you and the first day. And waiting for James to get the DVDs, all the conference information up for all the DVDs for all the presentations. But I wanted to talk about the crystal ship. I don't know, were you out there to see that crystal ship?
Oh, that was right after everyone walked out, just as we looked to the west.
Yes.
Is that the crystal ship that came in? Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we were out there in the field, you know, watching, and it was just dusk, and all of a sudden we saw something coming in from the west, and it was pretty low, and we could see that it was colorful. We could see like red, and I could see green, but as it got closer to us, as it was going, and it was going very slow, it got right over us, and it was like red and green and yellow, and we looked at, it was transparent. You could see through it. And it was really incredible because I had been there in 2008, and, you know, of course we've seen a lot of the ships, you know, in the light form. But I never experienced anything like that because I've had my own experiences over in my own area with unusual shaped spacecraft, but I'd never seen a crystal one. And I had mentioned it to Nate, and Nate had said that that they don't come over often, but they have seen them over there. And I guess John Riley did get a picture of it.
Yeah, he, when they walked out, he and William Henry were kind of standing together, and John always has his camera in his pocket. And, evidently it was a tremendous effort for him to lift that camera and get it on the ship, but he did get video of it. And interestingly enough, he has been trying to upload that video several times today, and, what happened was it crashed his computer. A couple of times.
Wow.
Yeah, so he's still working on that, trying to get that up, but can't wait to see that footage hit the airwaves because it's really quite amazing.
It was pretty phenomenal. I had brought six people with me this time. The four drove, of course. The four of them flew, and the three of us drove. And that was their first time ever experiencing anything like this, and as a result of me being there in 2008. And, you know, so they had to come out and see this. And they were just so astounded by all the speakers. And they had two young boys, 17 and I think 19. And, anyways, they were just absolutely, changed their life.
I think I met them. Real tall kids.
Pardon? Yes. All the tall, the tall people. Yeah. but anyways, Mitch and his wife, and his two sons, it just changed their life.
Well,
so anyways,
you know,
I am so glad to have met you again and Robin and sitting around the pit and just discussing just some, you know, just incredible things that are going on our planet, as well as off planet. And, we're in exciting times.
Yeah, it was interesting. I've never sat in a drumming pit before. I've heard of spirit drumming and that kind of stuff, and I was kind of lifted by it. I got to tell you, it was as it morphed and changed. It changed rhythm and it changed feeling to it. I don't know how many people had instruments around that fire pit. There must have been 16 or 18 people that had an instrument of some kind or another, from a tambourine to a bongo to a
unfortunately, I missed that. That was Thursday. We didn't come in until Friday night late. We missed that whole first day as a result, but nothing was going to stop me. We rented that car and we drove up there, and we got in there late Friday night, so I was able to make it there Saturday morning.
Well, we loved your energy. We loved having you there. It was a pleasure meeting you finally after hearing your voice on the radio all these months. And isn't it wonderful that this is not an archive tonight?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, I got in, I was trying to get in earlier, and my power went out, and I didn't know what had happened because we have a thunderstorm here, but I told you I have that turbine, and I don't know what the heck happened, but all of a sudden it went back on again, and right in the middle of me trying to call you, so.
Well, it was
a lot. Thank you, Brooks, for everything that you have done, and thank you for being part of ESETI and with James Gilliland. You really have been an incredible energy to be with the group. William Henry and Alfred Weber and Dolores Cannon, and I mean they were all fantastic. There wasn't one that was not. And I encourage anyone who's listening to this program or who knows anything about ESETI to go to the ESETI website and attend next year and get in early because they sell out early.
Well, they did this year, that's for sure. By the way, if any of you hear of other conferences out there, a couple of months ago I was up at the Questers Conference in Alberta, Canada. That was really, really neat. If you hear of any other conferences out there, we're always looking for speaking opportunities because we like telling the story and we like sharing our discoveries out there. So if you hear of any conferences in your neighborhood and you think you might need a good speaker with a good presentation, give us a call, drop us a line. There's a form at X Squared Radio that you can direct people to, and just fill it out. We'd be happy to come speak at your venue. And Diane, I appreciate you so much. Thanks for coming. Thanks for your energy, your dedication, your tenacity, and for showing up. So as we work on this, as we put it together, day after day, we refine what we learn. It's kind of interesting to see as we near this, what appears to be a very energetic place in our galaxy. And we hear Lisa Renee talk about this and others speak about this range of energy, this sort of standing wave of gravitational waves of a collection of photons in the galaxy. These things come together and it looks like we're picking it up consciously. And different people, depending on their skill sets and their mindset, their heart, pick up this information and interpret it slightly differently. And whether they're generating music or poetry or science or engineering, it seems to be coming from a unified source. And it's interesting to see the different perspectives come together in the same conference. Even though we don't collaborate, it does seem like a very collaborative effort. We have John from Vancouver on line two. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Oh. Agnew.
How are you, sir?
Well, thank you. You were talking about Einstein's equation equals mc squared.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not a mathematician, but I've always been curious about that equation. And for example, c squared is obviously way faster than the speed of light. So the question is that a real entity or is that just an abstract? Because if it was a real entity, that would violate Einstein's own theory about nothing going faster than the speed of light. But I've got two ways to visualize the way that looks. So c squared could actually be the square area that light travels in 1 second, like a plane. 300,000 kilometers squared. Does that make sense to you?
Now, c is the actual constant, which is 300,000 kilometers. That's the distance that light can travel in a single second. What they're
so
talking about
squared,
when they
that...
yeah, but when they square it, they're just relating it to the amount of energy that's released from the small amount of mass that's lost. For instance, when two hydrogen protons come together to make a helium atom, each proton loses a little bit of mass to do that. Well, that little bit of mass times the speed of light squared is the energy that's released from that union. That's what we see in a nuclear explosion.
Okay. I hadn't thought of it that way. What I was trying to get at, when you look at mass times c squared, there nothing about that suggests volume, and that's what caught my attention. Like it's
energy is not a
measurement.
There's
nothing in that formula that says 3D, except the presumption or the assumption that anything with mass has got three dimensions, which, if you look at a photon, that's not necessarily true.
Well, a photon can be either in the form of a wave, which, or a frequency, which we often deal with when we're looking at spectra of light, where we're looking at a package of energy, which we call a photon, or it can exist in the form of a particle, which it does once it's observed. Once we observe the spin of the photon, well, it collapses into being a particle. But energy itself isn't really a volume. It's just a measurement of, it's actually a unitless measurement in that equation. We often measure it in terms of watts or joules, which is a watt second. And that's how we measure energy. So it's not really a volume that we're looking for. What we're looking for is the amount of energy that's released. That's why that equation is so graceful and beautiful in its relationships.
Well, I agree with you. Okay, so a particle does a kind of, it works like a vector or a ray. And then
it does, yes.
A frequency, what a frequency implies to me is spin.
Yeah, spin or a sinusoidal action, like going positive and negative.
Yeah, well, like frequency to me always says spin. It's a vector that's spinning along a direction, so you're going to get positive, negative, positive, negative. And that creates the kind of holographic vibrations that you need for a universe to kind of have the information within itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Photons are information, no doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah. And with the vector and with the spin equals frequency, to me that's how the universe communicates within itself.
Well,
you've got the field and you've got the vectors. That's really what it amounts to.
Even between universes, because we do see virtual particles appearing and disappearing in our dimension from another dimension or another universe.
Yeah, we see, I've just gotten onto the idea of vectors. And vectors, from my understanding, like a purely mathematical directional type thing, is not subject to, say, gravitational field or anything like that.
That's what they say.
It travels in a purely straight line.
That's one of the reasons why we are studying gravitational waves, because as they ripple space-time, they're actually curving the threads of space-time along which these frequencies travel. That's how the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory up there in Washington works. They shoot laser beams, which are ordinarily straight. But if there's any kind of squeezing or stretching of the universe from gravitational waves, the length of that laser beam changes.
I find what you talk about really fascinating, and it's also really challenging to try and integrate and understand and create a new paradigm, really.
Well, we try to make it easy.
Because if you're talking about from the point of view of a photon, where time is zero and it travels from A to B instantaneously, that is difficult to try and integrate.
Yeah, it really is, to become omniscient in that moment and realize that the whole universe has always been at your access, past and present and future. But it's human consciousness that speeds everything up so that we can enjoy a meal or fall in love or wait for something. It's, you know, a photon doesn't have to wait for anything. It's there.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thanks, Dr. Agnew, and I'll just, try and digest everything that I've heard this evening.
No problem. Be happy to send you this math book on the shelf behind me. I know exactly what.
Okay.
I tell math students that there is crying in mathematics.
Well, yeah, I'm getting that because I'm sort of traveling into that. I just discovered POV, ray tracing software.
Oh, right.
And it makes beautiful images, but it's heavy duty on the math end. And in a way, to me, it's kind of like a metaphor for the way the universe is actually constructed. And that's what my fascination is about it. But I'm doing a lot of crying as I learn it.
Well, that's cool. Vector mathematics is not for the lighthearted, but at least you have a program.
Okay, well, I'll take that as encouragement.
Well, at least you got a what if there that you could play with and look at some imagery, and it makes the math real for you.
Exactly. That's the whole thing about it. Yeah. I recommend it for anyone that's interested in that kind of thing, turning math into a visual, beautiful visual presentation. It's fabulous.
Very good. Sounds like a good toy. Good for ages 8 to 80.
All right. Yeah. Okay, thanks, right. Dr. Agnew.
Thank you very much. Talk to you later.
Okay, bye for now.
All right, we'll take a short break. We're running a little bit over. Sorry, affiliates. You'll just have to live with it. We'll be right back after this. That you would just enjoy a poem right about now. It's a poem called Night Flight. Those of you that have ever traveled at night by air, sometimes when you look out the window, it's just inspiring on a clear night. This is Night Flight. Night Flight, blazing through ethered space at 10 miles a minute, o'er galaxies of ordered stars with corpuscles of red and white, glowing along gray veins, travelers with sundry destinations, soft halos, lonely and peaceful, spaced evenly in velvet hills, the reflected shimmer of moonlight dancing like white fire across thousands of liquid mirrors hidden in the darkness below. Oh, the condescension of dissension. As air speed yields to gravity and heaven becomes quiet, and a tilted wing points toward God, with frozen moonlight gracing silver skin like a dancer's gentle hand, mid-leap. And once again, wheels make for the green and rolling canvas from which we pray. Hope your family and you have had a wonderful 4th of July weekend and are ready to get back to a stretch of productivity this summer while we wait for the next holiday to punctuate our schedules. As you are considering those birthdays this summer and this fall, you might want to consider a book. You know, it's interesting. I go out to the bookstores from time to time to do book signings and just to check to see that my books are on the shelf, which sometimes they're not. I see a lot of people buying books, lots and lots of people. It looks like people are returning to books. They also listen to audiobooks. And one of the nice things about books like The Ark of Millions of Years and Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is that they are easy to read. They bring complex, sometimes far-reaching metaphysics to the average person by telling a story. And one of the things that you'll notice in the book, the Remembering the Future, is it isn't all math, okay? It isn't all science. There's a story to it, too. And it's my story. It's who I am and was and how I changed and how I remembered. I put it in the book as an example for you so that you could see that it can happen, that you can change, you can remember, and thus become empowered to change the past, which alters the future, which is your present right now. And I don't know how many of you out there are really, really happy, really satisfied with your present. But if you're not, or if you feel that there's something more, some reason why you have what you have spinning around inside your head, when you look in that mirror in the morning and you have a tendency to say, who's he? Who's she? What's she doing there? That person you are on the inside, that animated, eternal being that has the feelings, that has the desire, that has the will, that separates you, that makes you sentient and alive. That thing, that person, that being inside of you is timeless. And that's why I wrote the book Remembering the Future. And it's actually set in a setting to come to you from the year 2015. In many cases, you'll see why when you read the book. And very soon, it'll be available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere it sells books. But for now, it's at rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Available in ebook. Those of you that like reading books on your on your iPad or your iPod or your computer, you will also get 25% off the printed version when it comes out. And it's very soon now. We've been through all the editing and hopefully every last delay that the publisher might put upon us. And it is very soon going to go to print. We'll get a galley copy any day, and when we release that, it will go to print, and it will be to you. And then it's Katie by the door. We're going to change everything. This is a book that crosses over between self-help and metaphysics, self-help and New Age, as it were. As John was saying, it sets a new paradigm, brings you face-to-face with who you could be, and learn to dream large. Because isn't the sentience of humans and other beings driving the very observations that create the universe? I mean, every single sentient being has its own reality, has his or her own reality. And currently on the Earth, there are about 7 billion sentient beings, each with his or her own reality. Each reality is unique. And the universe, as it turns out, is the mathematical average of all these realities. What we see is the average reality. If you have a country full of 300 million people, which we do, the true reality of that country would be the average desire of every person in that country. Even communities and households are this way. If you boot out the bad people, the whole place becomes a nicer place to live, right? But if you allow the bad people to gain leadership, the whole thing ends up in the proverbial handbasket, does it not? The average consciousness of the universe is the collective reality most of us perceive, multiplied by our own reality. Two people can live in a small town. One thinks he is in hell, and the other one thinks he's in heaven. They're both right. Once they multiply the presence of the town by their own reality. The population of Earth is so large that the average reality is going to be statistically very stable. It isn't going to shift in value very much unless conditions independent of the individuals in the population change. For instance, adding the internet to the population allows people to meet, to talk, love, and even solve problems. This one condition also provides unlimited knowledge to anyone who wants it. And knowledge empowers the individual. But when it is given to at least a critical amount of the population, the average awareness changes significantly. In fact, a population can actually evolve with this kind of empowerment. Religions, governments, creeds, and prejudices will change. The set of beings on the planet will change. And if you add all the potential energy of the universe to the kinetic energy of the universe, the result is zero. The result is now. The result is a singularity. This means that the Big Bang never happened. The universe is still a singularity. Time has been created by sentient beings like humans to allow it to exist as space. Put more simply, you are the creators, at least the co-creators. You are sentient and are currently human in mortal form, or immortal form for some of you. You never die, you know. Your DNA is resonating with the energy of your environment, and the environment in which the genes of the body exist includes the consciousness of the being, the beings around the being, and the planet upon which it lives. The matter that makes up your body came from the planet. This one physical fact may entangle you with every other being on this planet. In fact, with every element in the vicinity of the last supernova in this neighborhood. This is the creation event that was engineered by the beings who live in this universe. Namely, you. You did it. The universe only exists because you are in it. If you leave, the entire universe would collapse as we know it. It is the power of your consciousness that allows it to exist in space and time. Neither of these two aspects even exists at the speed of light. The question is, why did you do it? Why did you slow down time or speed it up so that the universe could exist? The reason is so simple. You did it so that you could drop out of the void of singularity to behold the love of one another. You did it to savor the taste of chocolate. You did it so that you could listen to music, watch children play, and wind blowing across the fields. You did it to watch snow falling and feel the rain on your face. Knowing everything at once is not heaven. The experience of life, struggle, being in love, creating life in one's own image, and even dying a mortal death is the purpose of your existence. And you exist millions of times. There is no such thing as existed or yet to exist. This is only a perspective of yours. It all exists. It all happens. All of it. It is all possible. It is a potential of all potentialities. And the potential of it only depends on your ability to manifest this existence. That ability is empowered to the extent that you can remember the future and your past, which is the present. You are the only variable in the equation that you can control. So, do it on purpose, and by all means, remember who you are or were. Your birth here caused you to have a few years where your brain could not recall those experiences from your mortal lives that you've accumulated. So, the brain is a lens for the human consciousness. By the time the lens gets clear enough to focus your consciousness from all times into this dimension, you've forgotten how to hold it. That's what I'm going to do here. That's why I'm going to train you how to hold the lens and focus it again. That's what the book Remembering the Future is about. If you get the lens in the right position where you can focus reality, focus your consciousness, you can discover the ends of the universe. You can bring it all to bear in one point. And the interesting thing is, Earth has more beings on it now than have ever lived here before. I'm sure of it. You're sure of it. And at last, we are connected together where we can all communicate as one. People by people, town by town, city by city, and hopefully, hopefully, nation by nation, we can communicate one with another. We can evolve as a race. We can lay down our banners, our tribal flags, and thus our shields and our swords, and we can walk with one another instead of against one another. We can compete with ourselves and become great. We can compete together against our own potential and become greater. You know, it's an interesting thing when we talk about past lives. And it's sort of interesting. We hear it almost in passing. You know, people say, well, you know, in a past life I was this or I was that. I must have been in a past life I had that experience. It's almost a Freudian slip how it comes out, how we think of that. And it comes from the strangest people. It comes from people that we think are more or less not spiritual, not religious. Yet they throw this out pretty casually, pretty openly. We can read that in earth as it is in heaven is also written as in heaven, so in earth, in the New Testament of the King James Bible. Either way, it seems like it requires a little more practice. Mankind needs to employ in order to manifest the will of God in this earth. Keep in mind, I may be talking about the human body or the planet Earth itself, as both are made of earth. The moments during which the consciousness is extended like a crystalline fractal of our own third sight, like John was talking about tonight, vectors going off in every mathematical conceivable direction, influenced by the variables of our own will, into the void around us, can be the most beautiful and also the most disorienting of our experiences. In fact, third dimensional existence itself, sometimes called real life by most humans, can occupy the entire CPU of human consciousness when left to its own unconscious programming. Lord knows we meet enough people like that on the freeway, just driving along completely unconscious, unaware of where they are, what they're doing. It's a real strange situation to see. After all, we are either acted upon by the universe or we act upon it. We often look into the future or the past as we test one scenario or another in the crucible of our imagination. From a physics point of view, of course you know they're the same, it is just as far from here to there as it is from there to here, and time is actually measured in distance, especially in space. In the singularity of creation, distance was zero because gravity was beyond escape, all crammed into that little space. In space, light distance is the method by which we measure our universe at light speed. And at light speed, time becomes zero for the traveler. Thought, as empirical data is now proving out, is immeasurably faster than light. We humans are evidence that thought is fast enough to escape the pull of gravity inside the singularity. That's why we're here. Perhaps it's not affected by gravity at all. What do you think that does to time in the universe? One's mastery of focus might allow omniscience to at least make momentary appearances, enough to provide testimony that such a circumstance really does exist, because time slows down at the speed of light. Thus, the entire universe becomes visible to us, past, present, and future, all at once. I mean, mathematically speaking, all possibilities happen. Although it is difficult to process, our past is rather more difficult to expand to the potential of all potentialities than a past that does not involve us directly. If we're involved in it, we're kind of have a conflict of interest. For instance, reliving a traumatic experience and accepting the reality of a different outcome than we experienced is not possible in this dimension. However, accepting how that traumatic experience affected us personally is possible. In fact, it can be vital to allowing us to learn what we designed to learn and to move on to a more merciful and clear position in the universe. The echoes from such a failure mode can preclude progress in the human psyche if it is not cleared like a hurdle on a running track. You're going to stand there in front of it, never finishing the race. Divide by zero, or even a number very close to it, and we do get infinity, and we don't like infinity. Neither of these outcomes is desirable when seeking solutions that match our 3D way of thinking, but come on, let's face it. The universes are not really explainable in three-dimensional terms. They are balloons holding the energy of gods within them, collapsing into particles when mortality is desired and necessary, and existing as waves when unobserved. In fact, the distance waves travel is only relative to us, the sentience of the universe. For as we have learned already, it is our desire out of source for experience and existence that has sped time back up to create distance in the first place. One of the things we do when distance numbers become too cumbersome is we utilize bigger things to measure them by, lunar distances, solar distances, and even parsecs to explain time. As it turns out, it is only the human consciousness that can truly consider this. The distance across a single atomic bond, or the infinitesimal perturbation of distant suns by their unseen satellites, are as easily contemplated as the assembly of a child's toy, with or without instructions. We don't actually have a way to prove this, but it is widely believed that only human beings are capable of these imaginations. You know, the doggone Indians know from their earliest traditions that Earth is the sixth planet, not the third. That's because they count from the outer planets toward the sun. And it's really quite amazing to hear because Pluto wasn't even discovered until the 19th century. The doggones say that they are the people from the stars, although the permittivity of their existence belies this claim. That does not negate the prehistoric tradition that they are exactly correct in their perception of the motion of the galaxy and the origin of planets. Either they were taught by off-worlders about the universe far away from Earth, or they are surviving remnants of ancient travelers from other worlds. You know, you can't get there by car, or even by walking. These epiphanies can, however, be reached through meditation. It is how gods contemplate the smallest quanta and the birth of planets. It is how all creation occurs. It facilitates the blending of the conscious mind with the subconscious. The conscious mind, normally used to move the body about or to satisfy one's appetite or another, is completely different than the subconscious mind. And we're not talking about the unconscious mind. This is another matter altogether. That we can discuss another time. We'll do that in another program. We're talking about the conscious mind, or the mind that isn't conscious that it's conscious, but not the unconscious mind. One can easily find beings on all worlds who are unconscious. They are the ones who pass you on the sidewalk and emit no signal when they pass you by. They scold their children for not being adults and curse their own bodies for not allowing them to ever consume while maintaining the butt of a 16-year-old. They breathe air and drink all manner of concoctions and eat food, but they're not really alive. They are a vast sea of sleepwalkers. They are like pylons in the parking lot through which the awakened humans weave for sport. The synchronizing or tuning of the conscious mind with the subconscious mind is not easily done because they're way different speeds. Sometimes it can only be done for a few seconds at a time, maybe while staring at a candle or while in deep meditation. But ordinarily, the subconscious mind moves much, much faster than the conscious mind. Or it could be felt like a shape in the fog during that layer between sleep and wakefulness. It is a difficult interface in which to dwell for any length of time without practice. The conscious mind considers and processes variables of inputs to the human being, while the subconscious mind is the actual operating system or the program that's running at multiples of light speed underneath the keyboard. Numbers and words and sounds or other pieces of analog or discrete information are poured into the machine, and the subconscious mind cranks out the answers. Cells protect themselves against toxins, they respirate and even function quite well all the way up to the day they die without deviating from the program written at their birth. How does the program get written? What are the capabilities of the program? What inputs can it process? And are everyone's programs the same? Exactly. Now you're thinking. So as we pull all this together and we consider our universe, which in some cases is just our environment, just the local neighborhood, your cubicle at work, your family at home, the simple things, the contacts that you have on a daily regular basis, these are the things that make up your environment. And the environment is what programs the liquid crystal of the cell walls of each cell in the community called the human body. It's just a molecular layer of molecular switches, not unlike a silicon chip, only made with carbon-based amino acids and proteins instead of combination of silicon and boron like is sitting in your laptop that you're listening to this program with right now. That's simple enough. The binary code we have primitively utilized in our computers works on the same principle as the cellular processors, except that biological cells are able to process trinary, tertiary, and perhaps even more states of awareness. Zeros and ones switching back and forth sounds like it would be fast enough, but it still takes 3 minutes to boot up a computer, no matter what the clock speed is. Cells, however, facilitate immensely complex algorithms that would humble the best game designer. Consider the professional baseball player. That's a good one. Some observers would say that they are not the sharpest knives in the drawer, baseball players. I beg to differ. I used to play baseball, and I'm pretty sharp. Closer analysis would prove otherwise. A baseball, pitched at 95 miles an hour from the mound to the catcher's glove, covers the distance in 0.463 seconds, less than half a second. The average human body takes 0.75 seconds to begin moving after a visual or audible stimulus. The complexity of seeing the ball released, tracking the ball with the eyes to the strike zone, moving the hips, legs, shoulders, and arms to hit the ball at the optimum millisecond in less than 0.463 seconds is not biologically possible. Yet, it has been accomplished consistently by thousands of professional baseball players for more than 100 years. Observe a high-speed photo at home plate of the batter's face at the precise moment the ball is hit, and you will see his eyes as though he was waiting for hours, looking right at the ball resting upon his bat. Equally amazing is the fielder who sees the ball come off the bat, begins sprinting to an instantly calculated point of intercept, tracks the speed and trajectory of the ball, waits until the exact moment, and dives forward at 25 miles an hour to catch the ball while he is still weightless. Perhaps the baseball player is able to bring the subconscious mind to the moment of impact, operating hundreds of times faster than the conscious mind. The cellular subconscious program never reboots, and it never shuts down, and it cannot be overwritten until the cell dies. and is replaced through division of a live cell to replace it. By the time you're 14 years of age, every living cell in your body except your brain has been replaced. Each cell functions on its own, usually in a manner that benefits the whole body, with or without a nucleus. And without a nucleus, the only thing a cell cannot do is replicate. Cilia move debris like hands of a crowd might move a beach ball around an arena during a rock concert. Various liquids are produced to lubricate, dissolve, and even clean portals between the inside and outside of the body. Some cells face the outside interface and die by the millions each day, like the soles of the feet or the tips of the fingers. The program runs faster than any computer ever designed, and many hundreds of thousands of times faster than the conscious mind. Computers that match the speed of the conscious mind were invented in the year 2013. That much is understood. But how does the program get written, and what information is used to write it? Simply put, it is the environment that influences the writing of the program. The temperature, the humidity, toxicity, abundance, scarcity, and even the consciousness of the being itself and its surroundings are the bits of data used to write the program. And once it is written, it cannot be overwritten. That is to say, as long as that cell is alive, it will make decisions, respirate, protect itself from toxins, feed itself, and expel waste, all automatically, according to the last instruction. It does not need the nucleus or DNA. It does not need our conscious mind to carry out its functions. So again, how does the program get written? While the cell is alive, the program runs. When that cell dies, a cell beside it replicates to fill in the missing spot. It knows to be a muscle cell or a bone cell or that of a nerve by a very mysterious process of differentiation. But the whole organism goes on living because of this process. The environment at the time of this division is what writes the new program. That is extremely important to consider, although we are not really advocating deathbed confessions here. All of the information accessible by the cell at the time of creation is utilized to write the subroutine by which this cell will operate is written unalterably at this time. As long as that new cell runs, it will run this updated program. Now, you might ask yourself, how does the new incoming cell know to become a muscle or a tendon, eye tissue, or skin? You may have been taught that it simply consorts with the cell next to it to get that answer. Well, then that stimulates two more questions. What if the cell needing replacement is at the exact interface between two radically different cell types? What if there are only two cells, such as a sperm and an egg? How do they know which cell is which? Well, Dr. Bruce Lipton, author of The Biology of Belief, told me personally of an electromagnetic image of the creature that serves as the extra-dimensional pattern by which the physical cells simply fulfill, like a paint-by-numbers model. And if you don't believe me, then attend medical school and find out for yourself, because it's true. But think about it. Who makes the image of the being that the cells host? You do. That's correct. Your consciousness shapes and molds the very body that you occupy as a conscious being. The way you smile, exercise, comb your hair, lift things, and even feed yourself determines the shape of the vessel. You are the creator. You are the healer. And you are the judge of yourself by your own state of energy that is completely under your control. Not even God can overwrite your self-judgment. It is a program rule that forbids the foundation of the universe, and without which the entire universe would collapse back into the singularity it would be without you. So let's consider the environmental factors. The energy level of the cell is like the charge on a battery. It is a few electron volts, direct current. This DC level drops ever so slightly once the organism matures, and then a switch gets thrown that changes the way the power level is maintained in incoming cells. Somewhere around age 16 or 18, the cells begin to show age. They lose elasticity. They don't recover from injury as easily. The amount of sun damage, lack of moisture, overheating, overcooling, and level of nutrition for a cell changes its power level. Hormones flood the body, alerting it to the ever-pressing need to procreate, allowing it to change shape and function and prepare itself for falling in love. The cell resilience is switched to a subroutine until it gets instructions from you. When it divides, the new power level is inherited by the new cell. Every 7 years, the organism has replaced every single cell in the body except the teeth and the brain. These are not renewed once they are fully developed, at least under normal physiological conditions. No one has grown new brain cells after a stroke or regrown a tooth that has been pulled or had a spot of decay heal itself. For the rest of the cells, the total environment is considered. That means if you are bathing your organism in hatred or fear, then the frequency and power level of either of those energies will be written into the new cell's program. If you are bathing your organism in self-love, the same holds true. The more time you spend in the frequency of love, the better the chances that the cells of your biological transducer, the body, will be replaced with the higher frequency written into your cellular program. In other words, the subconscious program of your body, which has always been an integral part of your soul, runs with a program that has been shifted to a higher frequency. There are instruments and tools that can help the human being energize their own cells with new programming. You can learn all about those instruments as you do research and as you read the book, Remembering the Future. Those things are in there. And we try to explain it to you in almost story format. And you'll learn about me, and you'll learn about yourself, and you'll learn about what you can do and who you are and what you can be. And you'll learn what it's like to wake up in the human race. Some of you can only remember the human race. That's all you have. That's all you have at your disposal. But there's a lot more to it than that. You get glimpses of it from time to time. You get a little inkling of it in a dream or in meditation or at the end or beginning of a traumatic experience. Sometimes you see your life flash before your eyes, and it's pretty short, isn't it? If you go to the website, rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, one of the things you'll notice on the cover is I've got my high school graduation picture and I've got a recent photograph of myself. Well, to me, those two photographs are only a few moments apart. Obviously, if you look at the pictures, you'll see about 35 years separates those two. But that's okay. That's okay. That 35 years can be a very long time, can be a very short time, but that's only from our perspective. Because in reality, there's no time at all. It is all now. The past, the present, the future can be considered and therefore can be observed and therefore can be affected. And that's the key to the book. Now, there are areas in the book that teach you, it's not all philosophy, it is also mathematics. And as John was saying from BC, sometimes there's crying in mathematics. I do try to take all the crying out of it. There's not so much frustration because it's only simple addition. Okay, there's a little bit of long division in there, but I do it for you. I do explain it in great detail. And the reason that I do it is because it's important. that you understand that there is a method by which the universe resonates itself out of chaos into order. Oftentimes, my friends and I sit around the campfire, or sometimes around the calculator, or sometimes around neither one, and we talk about the universe, and why it is the way that it is, what are the odds that it could appear this way, what are the possibilities of other universes. And at the end of the day, a statistician would say, gee, there's at least 10 to the 25th different kinds of universes that could form. Why do we have one like we have? What are the odds? Well, about 1 in 10 to the 25th. But if you think about that natural resonance, you think about the golden mean and how those things have to constructively interfere with each other. That is to say, they got to build on each other in order to exist, because otherwise they annihilate each other. Then you realize this is the only kind of universe that can form. All universes are like this. And all beings, all sentient beings in all universes are just like us. So next time you knock yourself down, realize who you are. Realize the stature of the being that's inside of you. And if life is not going the way you want, the bounty and the abundance of life is not laying itself at your feet, that's okay, because that's the challenge of it. And challenge is why we're here. And if it was easy, it would be no fun at all. It's like building a sandcastle. Going down to the beach with your bucket and your shovel, looking forward to building the sandcastle, and you get there, and it's already built. Some people came before you and knew what you wanted to build, and they built it for you. And you get down there, you don't even get to get sand in the cuffs of your pants. You don't even get to earn a sunburn, because the sandcastle's already finished for you. Where's the fun in going to the beach? Where's the fun in digging down for that perfectly moist sand? You know, and you mix it with a little bit of water and you make those funny little poured towers. Oh, you know, do the poured towers? Well, you should try it sometime. Mix a lot of water with the sand and then let the sand run over two fingers extended like you're going to whistle beneath your lips, and let that sand run right off the ends of your fingers like liquid mortar, and it forms the coolest little towers. Oh yeah, you need to get down to the beach and try that. It's really cool. The process of building the sandcastle is the fun part, not the finishing of it. So if you're in the middle of the challenge, why don't you stop for a little while? Sit down, take a breath, revel in it, because you only get that here. You don't get that out there. There is no challenge out there, because you know it all, and you can't stub your toe when you're a spirit. Here is where the sweat is. Here is where the dirt gets under the fingernails. Here is where the difference between where you are and where you want to be exists. And that's the fun part. That's why you need a ladder. That's why you need a shovel. That's why you need willpower and desire. And that's the fun part. Building it is the love. And that's what we want you to discover. So next week on X Squared Radio, trust me, we'll have a guest. We've got a couple of great minds coming on to speak to us. We have Stanton Friedman coming. We're trying to get the author of The Happiness Genes to come on. I'm sure he will. And we've got some excellent broad thinking going to happen in the month of July. So be a part of X Squared Radio. Join us every Sunday live between 5 and 8. If you don't join us live, by all means, buy an archive. If you don't buy it at bbsradio.com, you can buy it at xsquaredradio.com. It sounds just like it does right here. And tell a friend about us, because we need some more archives going out there. That's what helps keep the lights on. That $20 a year, which is less than the cost of a cup of coffee a month, gives you access to more than 650 hours of interviews over the last few years. And believe me, they're all interesting. It's all great stuff. We have great phone calls. We cover great, deep thoughts. Because this is scientific talk radio for your mind. We discover the mysteries of the universe and of the earth right here on X Squared Radio. We need you, and I'm so glad so many hundreds of you showed up this last weekend at eSETI, and many of you listened to this program and came up and told me you were there because you heard it here. Thank you. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. It's the best gift I had all year. I love you. See you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.